Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Good morning. I'm Donna. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, it's so good to be here again. I'm just thrilled to be back at Girlstock. I was here last year, and I had more fun than I've ever had at a conference, and this year's the same way. It's so good to come back and see people that I met last year and ones that I knew from before and, you know, to get to hear great speakers, to just get to be a part of. I am humbled by this. You know, if I remember where I came from, and I hope I never forget, you know, it's a miracle that I'm a part of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I'm invited to come and join, you know, different conferences and fellowship. It's just incredible. I mean, I was a crippled human being, and the whole idea that I can actually be a functioning person and have a sense of usefulness is so important to me. Sonia, I love that song that you sang, because there aren't any shortcuts, you know. I'm a big shortcut girl. I wanted to get her done. You know, my husband calls me the fire aim. In other words, I'm like, bam, 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 bam. Did I hit anything? And he's the aim. Maybe, no, aim. Oh, my God. And, you know, he slows me down, and I would say that I speed him up, but that isn't the truth, because he is not to be sped. He's the guy who thinks everything through to the very end and usually ends up not doing much of anything. But I'm sure glad he's in my life. I love talking about the fourth and fifth step. It's all of these steps, all 12 of them, are just crucial to me. And they're so important in my life. And every time I have a new sponsee that comes my way and I get an opportunity to work with her and take her through the steps, I get to learn more and benefit more from them every time I do it. You know, it's healing. It's healing for me. I get a chance to look back at my past and a lot of times, you know, comfort them when they're in such remorse and regret over maybe something in their past that is really causing them trouble. I had 7 years of being in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and could not stay sober. And it was usually that I would get up to the fourth step, and then I would fall off. And I'm not blaming anyone. It was no one's fault. It was in time, on time, God's time, right? And I just hadn't heard the message that I could grasp. I just had not heard that. And I didn't have anybody to take me through those that really had the experience of being able to get down to the causes and conditions. And that's what's so important. You know, those other inventories that I did, like probably 4 or 5 or 6 of them, they had me write down every rotten thing I ever did. You know, every lie I told, every guy I slept with, every, you know, person's meds I stole, every, you know, whatever I did, you know, write down every crappy thing I did. And what I ended up with is a summary of what I already knew about myself, that I am worthless and that I'm hopeless and I'll never be anything good. And I remember one of the last times I did an inventory like that, I asked my sponsor at the time, I said, you know, I've done this before. And I said, what I end up with is knowing what a piece of crap I am. And she said, you know, that's what you're supposed to learn. That's what you're supposed to learn through this. Well, that's really not true. If you read in the big book where it talks about the fourth step inventory, there's nothing in there about write down any all the crappy things you ever did. Now, I got to tell you that in my relationship with Polly, who is the dearest, dearest friend in my life and also a really good sponsor, I mean, she has no problem telling me the truth, and I have no problem hearing it because there's so much love from her. And she treats me with respect. She doesn't talk down to me. And I would never dream of treating her any other possible way. She's a gift in my life. I just adore you. So in the interim, since we've been together, she knows everything about my life, I think. I mean, every once in a while, though, I'll say something and she'll go, "Really? I didn't know that." And, I was, you know, it was caught in one of the files and it just didn't come up, you know. But I think, as far as I know, she knows me pretty well. And when I call her, there's no catching up involved. I mean, she knows exactly where I am. And she's current. And I like that. I like having somebody, I like having a relationship like that where there's complete mutual trust. And the women that I'm blessed to sponsor are the same way in my life. They are precious to me. And the time that I get to spend with them is precious, you know. And most of the women that I get to sponsor come to me just like I came to Polly, and that was under the "I don't deserve it, I won't bother you much," you know. And they're like hiding, they're like, okay, you know. I got to tell you what I learned from Polly is how to love. When I first got Polly as a sponsor, I had two sponsors that died, and I had my son and daughter that died, all in the same slot. Like my sponsor Aline, who had 35 years of sobriety, died about 4 months before my son did, and then 6 months before my daughter did, my other sponsor Barbara, who had 35 years of sobriety, died, and then my daughter died, and I was floundering. And I got Aline's husband, who was an old timer, and he refused to be my sponsor because he said, you know, men sponsor men, women sponsor women, but he said, "I'll always be here for you." And I said, "That's good enough for me." And so I would take him food. I mean, I remember showing up there one day with a payday bar just because I wanted to go see him and I wanted to take him something, you know. And I talked to him about things. And he was grieving his wife. And I was grieving my kids. And he wasn't afraid of my pain. He didn't say, you know, "Don't stop 5 minutes before the miracle happens." He didn't say, you know, "This too shall pass." You know, there were people that did say those things to me, and I wanted to slap the crap out of them. I mean, those are not appropriate responses, in my opinion. But he said, "You know, I can't imagine how you feel, but I'm here for you." And those were the things that meant the most to me, when people said, they didn't presume how I felt about things. And Polly never did that. She has been there with me through marriage and divorce and marriage again, and good times and bad times and, you know, all kinds of times. Before I forget, I want to talk about my cane. A lot of people have asked me, "Why are you carrying that walking stick?" You know, well, it isn't that I come from Montana. It's I just had to bring a little country with me. I've had two really serious car accidents in the last 2 years. One was in March of 11, and the other one was April 7th this year. And I had a bad concussions, which created a brain injury and some spinal issues, which don't bother me as much as the brain thing does. That's really irritating to try to live with. You know, when you can't believe what you think or what you feel or what you know, I mean, that's really exasperating, you know. anyway, but my balance is off the charts right now. I mean, I can't hardly, if I wasn't holding onto this podium, I'd be all over the stage. So that's why I carry that walking stick, and it really does help me a lot. But so many people have asked me, what's this for? You know, and so I thought I'd just make the announcement, and then everybody knows. Okay. So anyway, back to the fourth step. I had a life. Marilyn S. was here last year, and she I love her so much. She is so profound in the things that she says, and she quoted, I think it was Socrates, and she said that Socrates said that an unexamined life is not worth living. And she said that she likes to say an unlived life is not worth examining. And that's what I had. I had an unlived life. I never dreamed that I would make it past 20. I come from a very violent and abusive home. I'm talking about guns going off and people getting hurt. And I was the silent kid. Even though I was the oldest, I was the silent one. I didn't want anyone to know what was going on. So I kept all this stuff to myself. And I didn't, you know, I brought that all into AA with me. And, you know, I didn't tell anybody about that stuff. I didn't want anybody to know the kind of secrets that I had. And, you know, it included all varieties of abuse eventually. And, you know, that kind of stuff went on my fourth step when I eventually did one. And I was lucky because I ran into a woman who did it out of the big book. And she said, you know, write down your resentments, and what you're looking for is the big chunks. She said, we don't care about, you know, what happened to you in first grade. I mean, if that's a big deal to you, write it down. But right now what we're looking for is the big chunks, because this isn't going to be the last one you ever do. More will be revealed. And so I started off, and she also said to me, and I think for me, I need to see you after the meeting, Pam. for me, big chunks. Okay. For me, I had about, good job. For me, on my first inventory that I did in New Jersey with that woman who took me through the big book and said, write down these resentments, I had about 6 or 8 people on my first inventory in the column of resentments. And ultimately, I ended up with a whole lot more, because you end up realizing, oh, yeah, well, maybe there's that one, and maybe there's this one. And, you know, in fact, I just recently, last year or a little before that, ended up making amends to my first ex-husband. I carried a resentment toward him, but I didn't call it a resentment. I just said I hated him. And I had to face him one day at a family funeral, and it tore me apart. I just sobbed and sobbed, and I called Polly and said, I have to see you. And with schedules like hers and mine, we had to schedule about 3 months out, but we eventually got together, and I flew down to Florida, and we did a, you know, the whole deal, the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. And when I left there, I was ready to do a ninth with him. And it doesn't take forever to do these steps. Somebody who tells you, you know, do a step a month, if you're an alcoholic of my variety, you can die like that. You know, I mean, if you give me an inch, I'll take a mile. I was told don't take longer than 2 hours. Turn off your phone. Turn off the TV. Silence. 2 hours. Pray before you start. Ask God to help you, to reveal to you the things that need to go on this resentment list. Now, I know a lot of people back home who raise their eyebrows at that and say, oh, you can't possibly do a fearless and searching moral inventory. And I said, you know, for me, I could, any self-respecting alcoholic can tell you in 5 minutes who's on their resentment list, you know. I mean, bring it, baby, you know? I mean, it's not hard. You don't have to dig hard to find those things. So they said, write down the person's name. Next to it, write down a couple of sentences about the cause of it. When we do the fifth step, you can elaborate. And then there's that third column where it gives you the what it affects in me. And I've never really found a whole lot to add to that column. I mean, it's pretty basic. It's my, you know, self-esteem, my pride, my self-worth. My self-worth isn't on there. Security. Yeah, okay. Somebody's done the fifth step, fourth step here. I have, really. But anyway, make that list. Go to the next person. I mean, just do it like that. The only one I got hung up on was my best friend, who was my best drinking buddy, who left my life when I got sober. Now, she was someone that we were going to raise each other's kids if something ever happened to either one of us. She was my dearest friend at the time. And she just bowed out of my life, and I was really hurt over that. And I couldn't understand. And I tried to talk to my ex-husband, who was the president of AA. And, I mean, he was. Self-acclaimed. He told everyone that. Newcomers would come up to him and say, "Are you really the president of AA?" And he'd say, "Yes, I am." And I married him. So anyway, I couldn't see through that one a long time, and I asked my husband, you know, what do I do with that? And he said, oh, that was a drinking relationship, blow it off. But, you know, that relationship went a little deeper than that, and it was something I needed to handle, and I eventually had an opportunity to handle that. But I put it on my resentment list. And then after I finished my resentment list, I called my sponsor, and I said, I've got it. It's done. And I still have in my possession somewhere my original fifth step that was done on a word processor. I mean, it was a while ago. And then you go to the fear list. And it's like what Michael said last night. She said, she went to Polly and said, I have a fear of flying. And Polly said, no, you don't. You have a fear of crashing. You know, and people who think they have a fear of water, they have a fear of drowning. So you have to look for the causes and conditions. So what I do, you know, maybe one of the women will say, I have a fear of cancer. And I'll say, okay, what happens if you get cancer? Well, I'm going to have to go through chemo and radiation and that kind of thing, and I've seen my friends struggle with that, and it's really tough. Is that a cowbell? Oh, it's the light. Oh, it sounds like a cowbell. Anyway. Yeehaw! Anyway, so what happens if you have to go through chemo and radiation? You know, well, it's really, you get really sick and you lose all your hair and you drop a bunch of weight and it's horrible. I've seen people just torn apart going through that process. I have a sister-in-law right now who's going through that process. And it's, you know, it's god-awful. And I've also seen people who have said, just forget it. I'm just going to ride this out. You know, I'm just going to take it as it comes and go on till I'm not going anymore. And I think the choice is perfect. It's individual. It needs to be done by the person who's involved, and it also needs to be respected by all the other people whose lives are affected by that person. So you get down. Okay, what happens when you get really sick? You know, well, it either causes the cancer to shrink or you die. Okay, what happens if it causes the cancer to shrink? Well, if it does that, then you have a little bit of a shot, you know, and you have to start really, really slow. You can't even eat food. You have to start like a baby all over again with just soft food and very little exercise and all that stuff, but eventually you can gain and build up on it. Well, what happens if you die? Well, then you get to find out something I don't know. And that's what happens after this, you know? I am not somebody who believes that when life ends, it's over. You know, I believe that it's not like blowing out a candle. The flame is here, the flame is gone. I believe that I just go to the other side. And I think the day I was born, I came from somewhere, from a form of life, and entered into this world. And that on the day that I pass, it's going to be a new birth. I just believe that. It's something that I can say in my heart that I get it. And anyway, so when you follow that fear list down to the nub of what are the fears, each individual one, you know, it all comes back to the third step. Did I make a decision to turn my life and my will over or not? Did I say, you know, I'm going to follow God unless I get cancer? And then I'm going to, you know, I got it from here, God. I'm going to, you know, freak out. My decision is permanent. You know, one of my sponsors that passed away, Barbara, she was from Chicago. And she was a hoot. She got sober in 1957. And she was one of those 2 feet on the ground alcoholics. You know, I don't think I ever did the steps with Barbara. But she was sponsoring me at the time that Daniel committed suicide, my son. And she said, she called me up one day and she goes, "Dana, Barbara." She said, I got an idea. And so she says, "Come over." So I went over to her house and she told me, "I think you need to make an earthquake plan." And we were living in Southern California. And we get earthquakes all the time. And she said, "You need to make an earthquake plan." An earthquake plan is a contract that you draw up for yourself of what you're going to do if the wheels totally fall off. And this was before my son died, actually. And she said, "Think well before you put it down on this list because it's non-negotiable." And so I went home and I thought, what I'll do is 90 and 90. What I'll do is keep sponsoring the women I'm sponsoring and stay active in my service commitments and stick by my sponsor real close. And then the other thing that I added was I won't buy anything more than like a new sweater or something, you know, because I saw so many people do retail therapy. You know, I lived down in Palm Springs area, Palm Desert and Rancho Mirage, and there's a lot of money down there. And so these women would retire down there with a lot of sobriety, and their husband would die, and they'd go nuts. I mean, I knew one woman that had her carpet dyed. Now, don't you think it would be easier to just put new carpet down? Leave for the day. And but anyway, you know, and then she repainted, and then she changed her decor, and then she sold the house and moved to Colorado. And about a year later, she showed up back in the desert, broke and, you know, frustrated, and she hadn't been able to fix what was wrong in the inside by changing the outside. So I made up my mind I wouldn't do that. And so I took it to Barbara, and she agreed. She said, "That's a really good contract." And she said, "Now sign it, and I'm going to sign it, and you have to swear that you'll follow through with this." And at the time, she was thinking, what if my husband died? Because he was 12 years older than me, and he was sober longer than me, and she thought that my sobriety was kind of hinged on him. And really, it was kind of the other way around. But so I signed the contract, and I had it in my underwear drawer for a long time. What happened was my son committed suicide. And she said, "It's time to get that contract out." And so I did what it said. The only thing I changed was instead of doing 90 and 90, I went to a meeting every day because I know me. If I miss one, I'll miss 10. And I was too afraid. I hated being in AA. I hated, you know, people talking about how they had, you know, muffler problems with their Mercedes-Benz, you know. I hated that. I was so, you know, non-compassionate. But At any rate, I stayed because I didn't know where else to go, and I kept my commitments. What turned out, though, interesting, is that all my sponsees left me. Every single one of them let me go and said, I need to do something else. I need to do something else. And I didn't understand at the time. And I thought, what the heck ever happened to we don't go through anything alone, you know? We don't ever have to be alone. I mean, what's this about? But what I learned later is that if I had someone I could hold on to, a physical group or sponsor, at the same time, remember that my sponsors were dying. So if I had someone I could hold on to, I wouldn't have had to stretch for a new relationship with God like I did. So, I mean, I was desperate. I had made a truce with God when I got sober, but that was actually about as far as it had gone, and it was time for me to make peace with God. It was time for me to truly turn my life and my will over. And so that's what came through in my fourth step, because I had a lot of anger and resentment. So anyway, after that list is done, it was the sex inventory. And what time did I start? I have like 20 minutes left? Okay. Okay. Now about sex. In the sex inventory, I tell the women I sponsor that sex is not necessarily a verb. You can also look at it as a noun. In other words, what is my sex? I am a female. How have I used who I am and what I do to get my way, to punish, to reward? You know, I get pulled over by the cops. I want to be as cute as possible. You know, oh my, I didn't realize I was going that fast, you know. Or if I didn't feel like getting the stuff from Costco out of my trunk, I'd say, honey, can you help me with this? You know, and of course the guys are like, yeah, I can help you. And, you know, I used that. But here's a significant way that I used it that really came through to me. I mean, those other examples were extreme. But what I'm saying is that one of the things that I did to manipulate my relationships with I'll just tell you, and then maybe I'll think of the word. Like with my kids, on my sex list was, it didn't matter whether it was my mother, my siblings, my lover, my friends, my children, everybody was on there. And I was surprised at that. But with my kids, I could see very clearly, my sponsor pointed out, you know, what did you do when you were angry? And what I did was I would withhold my affection. That's the word I was looking for. I would look at them. I mean, I would talk to them, but I wouldn't look at them. You know what I mean? I'd look away. I'd look down. I wouldn't give them my attention. And, you know, that's how I use who I am as a woman, to punish or reward. That's how, and really it's just a way of manipulating, you know. I had to look at those things and realize that, you know, my sex life, being a woman in recovery, was God-given. And I have to respect that, you know. I do know people with a lot of years of time that are still out there trolling, you know, still doing the 13-step deal. And I just think, how can you do that? You know, how can you... Well, I mean, I can't judge someone's sex life, but I can tell you this. If I were to, you know, throw dirt in the face of the spiritual principles that I have been given, and just realize, you know, think I can get away with anything I want to get away with, that I wouldn't be growing very much. You know, it requires some sacrifice. The fifth step was not a problem when I did it with this formula. Then in the next, you know, little bit that you read, it says we go back to the list for there it held the key to the future. It says we disregard the things that others have done. So that means you block out the middle list. And then we disregard the other people involved entirely. So what's left? What effect did it have on me? And what I looked at was that it didn't matter whether it was my mom, my dad, my kids, my friend, my brother, my lover, you know. What I needed from them was safety, love, and security. That's what I hungered for all my life. And you know what? Those things are God-given. You need to have those things. Those are yours just because you live and breathe. However, you can't get it from them. The only place you can get safety, love, and security is from your higher power and from yourself. I remember when I did, when I came upon the seventh step, one of the things that surprised me so much was it was pointed out to me that I was lazy. And I thought, lazy? You know, I'm not lazy. I mean, I'm, you know, busybody, clean house, run the show, manage the world. And what they said was, I'm lazy because I don't take responsibility for the condition of my own life. I don't take responsibility. What I do is try to charm you or manipulate you into giving me what I need so that I'll be okay. And when I don't get that, I end up resentful. It's just so simple. It's just so simple. And every time I go back to that list, and I'd still do inventories today. Not very often anymore does something come up. I had these two car accidents, and I have mental disabilities. I have a permanent brain injury, and I have back and neck problems, and I'm definitely impaired, and I have to walk with that stick. But Carolyn has the stick. But, you know what, it's okay. It's okay. The first accident I had, after about 2 years, I started getting a whole lot better, but I worked at it. You know, I did word puzzles where you do, I have a thing on my little next book that's it's called Twist Text, and you just have to switch the letters around and find all the different combinations. And that's a way to improve brain function. And I do that, and I, you know, they say do crossword puzzles, that helps. And just you have to push. You just have to keep pushing. And it's embarrassing that I don't know things that I really should know. You know, on one of the diagnoses, it said that what was going to be impaired for me was balance, was multitasking out of the question. Cannot do two things at once, and then I can't make executive decisions. Now tell that to an alcoholic. Oh, yeah? Watch me. I came home one day with this box of beef. There was I went by the mall, and it was set up in the parking lot. It was this big old truck of frozen beef, right? And it says, Omaha like steaks. And it was, I forget what the price was now, but I thought, oh, that's a good deal, and my husband likes ribeye steaks, so I pull in the parking lot, and I buy the whole box. And it's like, I don't know, almost $200 or something, you know. And I take it home and say, look, you know, well, we opened it and found out that there's like six steaks, there's, you know, six packages of stew meat, and there's six packages of hamburger or whatever. There's different types, grades of beef. And then Bob figured it out on the calculator, and we were spending $7.99 a pound for hamburgers. I was like, I'll take it back, you know. So I do this all the time, you know. My brain just doesn't work like it used to. And I just learn how to get along. And the women that are in my life are real patient with me about that. Makes me a really good sponsor because I can't remember crap. One of the things, I mean, when they did give me their fifth step, it's like, you know. But you know what's weird is that I can occasionally remember the things I'm supposed to. Like when an event comes up or a circumstance comes up again, I can say to them, is this familiar? Have you done this before? How did this work out the last time? You know, God just recalls it for me. But here's another thing, too, is that I have migraine headaches, which are just wretched. And I get them like every day almost. And they have given me medications and they'd work for a little while. And then they, you know, would announce to me after a couple of months that the medication I was taking for the migraines caused migraines after a while. Thank you. And so anyway, after going through several different kinds of like Amitrex and things like that to deal with the migraines, they finally came up with the solution of giving me Botox. Eat your heart out, Deborah. I have 31 shots of Botox in my forehead, my scalp, down my neck, and across my shoulders. I get it every 3 months, and it's free. So, see? There's good things that come out of everything. I have to tell you that, you know, an unlived life is not worth examining. And before I came to AA, I never looked beyond my nose. My life was based on survival. And that was all I could do, was just survive day to day. And I didn't make plans. Sonia and I were talking about that this morning. I never had plans. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I never believed I would grow up. You know, I believed I would die before that ever happened. And, you know, several times it came close. But so consequently, I ruined a lot of good things that could have happened in my earlier years. But, you know, my life went the way it went. I got married and I had 5 children, and they were beautiful, young, you know, talented, gorgeous kids. And every single one of them have artistic abilities of some kind. My daughter produces CDs. One daughter just sings like an angel. And my youngest daughter is what does she call it? It's like a midwife, but
a doula.
Yeah, and she just, that's her passion. That's the whole deal for her. My oldest daughter has a master's degree in teaching and is just devoted to that and her family. She just adores her daughter. She's spoiling her rotten. I mean, she tells Renaissance every day, you are so beautiful and so smart. And she is. And Renaissance goes, I know. And I tell Trina, you're creating a monster, you know that. But she is so sure about what she's going to do. She's 13 now, and she's so sure about what she's going to do with her life. She wants to be a scientist and work on robotic technology that performs surgeries and things like that. Just, you know, it's great. My oldest daughter, my second daughter, Tracy, died at 25 years old, and she had a virus that melted her heart, and it was 2 years and 9 months after Daniel died, and it was called idiopathic giant cell myocarditis. And in other words, they didn't really know what was wrong, you know, and they just gave it a name, but it was a really rare kind of myocarditis, and I guess there was only 63 cases ever diagnosed in the whole world. Now her daughter is now 20 or 21. She's married and she is madly in love with her husband. She lives a very spiritually based life. They both do. And they're getting ready to move to Australia. And I mean, it's just wide open for her. You know, her life is just free and easy. She can do whatever she wants. And it's just so great to see them like that. You know, me, I was trying to survive the next day or this day. And, you know, they have so many more choices than I ever believed I did. And, you know, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd still be living that way. If it wasn't for the steps that have scrubbed out all that garbage and have shown me that I was wrong. I was wrong about God, and I was wrong about myself. I wasn't a piece of crap. And I was wrong about God. God didn't make any of these things happen. You know, sometimes I hear people say that God never gives you more than you can handle. I don't believe that. I think life gives me more than I can handle every day. And that's what I need God for. I have a meditation book that I love, and it's non-conference approved, but it's a really good book. And it says, life breaks my heart again and again and again until it stays open. And I just love that. You know, that's what's happened to me, because I was a closed up, freaked out little person who just, I didn't want to throw a shadow. I didn't want to draw any attention to myself. And today I believe I'm more open than I've ever been, and I'm more loving than I've ever been. When Polly first started sponsoring me, we were going somewhere to hear her speak in an afternoon somewhere down in California. And she's driving, and she reaches over and takes my hand. And I was sitting there going, she's holding my hand. And every little bit I'd go, she's still holding my hand. I mean, I was like, don't touch me. You know, I was so not able to be open. But over the years, I mean, we just love and hug and smooch all the time. I mean, people, you know how we all are. And we're not just that way with each other. We're that way with everybody. It's just, it's such a freedom to be able to be who I am today and accept my imperfections. I believe that we are all perfectly imperfect. So God bless you, and I'm so happy to be here.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.